Do you recall the political climate during the period, the 1930s, ever influencing the market? Or were you as Jobbers not really aware of it in the course of trading?
I think we were, Jobbers have to be aware of everything. You see, a jobber really shouldn't take more, I'm generalizing, he probably shouldn't take more than a week's thinking in advance, because he's a trader. And that is where people are going wrong today. They're not trading anymore. They think they're jobbers, and they're not. They're gamblers. And a jobber had to take notice of politics, because people are very funny. If there's a row about Mrs. Thatcher today, and she looks as if she's going, it affects sentiment. But only perhaps for 24 hours, but it's bound to affect sentiment, and somebody's bound to sell something. That may sound silly. And tomorrow morning, they wish they hadn't, they may even buy them back, and Mrs. Thatcher's fine again tomorrow. So you can't ignore politics at all as a stock jobber. You, in fact, a broker probably can. You can say, oh, Mrs. Smith, don't sell the stock. It's all one, but we're traders. Somebody's going to sell a stock. Wrongly, perhaps.
Well, do you recall particular crises of the period affecting business?
Well, I mean, there was the abdication. You see, that I don't really remember what effect it had the stock exchange. It's too long ago, but I'm damn sure it would have had a dampening effect on the stock exchange, which meant a few people felt miserable and sold stock. A lot of people sell stock or buy stock on impulse. You can't explain it, but it's a fact. Oh, Christ, I'm going to sell some stock. I feel miserable. Or I'm going to reduce my overdraft because the king's abdicating. I mean, it's a fact of life. As a trader, you've got to recognize all these things.
Well, can we take up the story of your career again? About the mid-30s, you became an authorized dealer.
Yeah.
And you're working on the Australian book with a few other miscellaneous stocks. How did things develop for you?
Well, I suppose you can say they developed quite well. I mean, I got married in 1936.
How had you met your wife?
Oh, at a dance, I think.
She wasn't connected with the stock exchange family or anything like that?
No, just a dance. That's the first time I remember meeting her, but I mean, I think it was probably at a dance. I do remember, if it's of any interest, that when in 1935 I was earning as an authorized dealer, authorized clerk, I was earning $400 a year, and with a possibility of a bonus. And the senior partner said, "I don't approve of long engagements. When you get married, we'll raise your salary to $500 a year." Can't believe it really now, can you? But I just went steadily on really without, the market, if I remember rightly, in mining shares was reasonably steady, and we made a reasonable living. And I couldn't tell you what my bonus was, but it wouldn't have been very much. I mean, by modern standards, it was probably quite a bit. I suppose the bonus might have been $200 a year, something like that. And I just went on really as an authorized clerk, or we call it authorized, you would call it, a dealer was called an authorized clerk, until the war broke out.
At some point, did you become a member?
I became a member in 1935.
How did that come about, that the firm decide that it would be?
Well, my father, the firm liked it, and my father very kindly put up the money. You had to buy a share and a nomination. And I think, funnily enough, the firm bought the share and my father bought the nomination. So it was a sort of a bit of a joint. Now, the nomination was more than a share. And that was in 1935. So I became a member, which is, it was a bit of a cachet, I suppose you can say, to be a member and a dealer. Made no difference, actually, in the effect of anything on the floor, really. Except if you trod on somebody's toe, you could answer back.
Are there any particular characters that you remember from the stock exchange during that period? Any characters in the mining market?
Well, it's a bit blurred, to tell you the truth. I mean, they had some chap in the copper market who was known as the Zulu or something. Some night Zulu, and about once, I can remember on one occasion going out in the sunshine, not that it really mattered, the sun was shining, and walking down the street were six members of the stock exchange, walking down the street with grass skirts round and their suspenders and their no trousers, they got grass skirts, I think they had pants and all that sort of thing on, with spears and blackened faces. And they went into the stock exchange and did a sort of war dance around the Zulu. It was some name like the Zulu, and they used to attack the Zulu, I don't know, when they had nothing else to do. They used to open a drawer, an empty drawer on one of the desks for the stock exchange, and get an apple. They didn't ask me why it was an apple, but and make a sort of boom, 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 boom. And business more or less stopped, and everybody gathered around the Zulu when this boom, 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 boom came out. And they sang some song. I can't remember what the bloody hell it was. But I think it must have been his 50th birthday when they came round, where they did the war dance and their sort of skirts and black faces. Mind, there wasn't much to do in those days. There were certain characters, you know, sort of, but not, I can't really remember them too well.
Do you have any memories of the partners in the firm at Lazarus? Lemon Brothers.
Well,
at that Lazarus time.
The other one, of course. Mm. They were the great.
How would you describe them? Were they strong disciplinarians? Did they run the firm on?
Well, the answer is yes, they were, but they didn't have to be. It's a different. We accepted discipline in those days, especially if you'd been to a public school. You accepted discipline; it didn't cross your mind. I mean, it was very firmly run, very fairly run. But I mean, when I first went there, I was not allowed, quite rightly in my view, to leave the floor of the stock exchange unless I wanted to go to the lavatory or go out to lunch. I was not allowed to go out and have a cup of coffee. Or certainly wasn't allowed to have a drink of any sort. And I think basically, upon reflection, it was quite right. Now they go out a coffee at 10 o'clock and pint of beer or something at 11 o'clock and bugger if I know what they don't. I mean, it's not the same, but it wouldn't happen. You weren't allowed to do it, but you didn't argue. And then on your birthday, you're allowed to do it. And if it was somebody else's birthday, you were allowed to go out and have a drink. So, you know, it just worked. They didn't need discipline.
Did you find them fairly imposing people?
Well, of course, when I first went there, I thought they were sort of, you know, God, I suppose. But after you got been with them for, you know, 5 or 7 years, you began to realise. You see, I think it's a bit of a leveller. When you think Sam is God and you listen to him dealing and he makes a balls of everything and loses a few hundred quid in 3 days running, you don't have the same respect for him. You think, well, they make a bloody fool themselves, like everybody else does.
People have said that the brokers and jobbers were quite distinct groups of people. Did you ever feel that that was the truth? That was true.
Yes, I did. I think, and I may say this, that some jobbers ought to have been brokers and some brokers ought to have been jobbers. It's a different way of life. A broker has to deal with it, is an agent. You've got to remember one thing, the jobber is his own, is a principal, and it's his own money. The broker is not his own money. It's the poor old client if he loses money. The only thing a broker's got to worry about is to make enough commission, be nice to people, and have the brains to do it. The jobber had to live on his wits. And there aren't, a lot of people can't live on their wits. So there was a different type of person. And I think a job has got to be a bit tough. Not rude, perhaps, but tough. You mustn't be all things to all men as a stock jobber. It's fatal. Because they come and, oh, Dick, you know, there's a very different, I've got a new client, and, you know, if any of you sell me this stock, you know, my name will be so nice, and you fall for it once or twice, and the next minute, up they go, and you've lost yourself, you know, and you realise you've been an idiot. So you've got to be, I'm sorry, George, can't do it. Can't help your client. That sort of attitude you've got to have.
What was the attitude to jobbing as a profession? Were jobbers regarded as being slightly second class compared to brokers?
No.
There was no real social
distinction. I'd say, if anything, the reverse was true.
Could you elaborate on that a little bit? In what sense?
Well, I think they respected the jobbers because they realised the jobbers took risks. Admitted in those days, or my day, well, it was, well, they're all relative. They took the risks that they knew that, and they respected the jobbers because they were probably more honest than the brokers. They respected them, I think, because they knew more what was going on. I mean, if the chairman of the stock exchange wanted to know what was really going on the floor of the stock exchange, he'd go to a jobber, he wouldn't go to a broker. Because any broker saw each other. Don't forget the jobber. Especially if it was a big job, he practically saw every firm on the stock exchange. I mean, I've been up before now and told the stock exchange, the chairman, that so-and-so is a bloody crook. Or we think that so-and-so would be broke within 6 months. They don't always take their notice, mind you, but you could know.
Now, were you still with Lehman Brothers when war broke out?
Well, yes, I was still when the war broke out and was still there when I came back. And then in 1948, the George M. Hill & Company stood about as far away as that door from where I'd been standing for the last, since about 1935, my father. There were two brothers. I had an uncle in the firm. So they'd like me to join them. And I thought very long about it, because I had loyalty to the firm. They'd been very good to me, and they'd paid me a small sum in the war, not very much. And I felt very loyal, but eventually I decided that Lehman Brothers was going downhill, which it was, and I thought I'd be all right. And I liked that Alec Hill, who was the senior, well, he wasn't, his father was still the senior part then, so I changed firms. Best thing I ever did.
In what sense were Lehman Brothers going downhill? Were they?
Well, Claude Lehman, who was the boss, was a wonderful man. He died in the war. He died young. I mean, I don't know what of. And all the other partners, the pre-war partners, had either gone to the war, and one of them was killed. The sort of mainspring of the sort of post-war firm who would have been the senior partner was killed, and the rest of them, basically speaking, were not all, but the more senior ones were too old, you know, got to retirement age. See, my father was got to retirement age, you know, about that time, in 1940 or 1950, and there was nobody at the top of the firm to run it. And also, I may be talking slightly, I don't, but the Kaffir market wasn't the power it was before the war. I don't know whether apartheid had started, I don't really know, but there wasn't, it wasn't some, and it was just sort of falling apart, really.
So did
bad management, you could say, not enough senior partners.
So did George M. Hill offer you a partnership, or did you go in as a...
No, offered me a partnership. That was another sore point, because they wouldn't make me a partner in Lehman Brothers. That's why I left, partly. Don't know why they wouldn't, I really couldn't tell you.
How would you describe, George M. Hill as a firm, perhaps contrasting them with Lehman Brothers?
Well, first of all, Lehman Brothers was spread. I mean, it was in a big, I mean, the Kaffir market was a bigger market in those days than the miscellaneous mining market, both in money-wise, price of shares, etc. And they had interests, as I said before, in oil market and the industrial market, not very big, but enough. And they were in the copper market, which we weren't at that time. So Lehman Brothers was a bigger firm and more spread around. Well, George M. Hill was a much smaller firm, concentrating really on the Australian market. Well, it's the Australian market, and Lehman Brothers was a part of a bigger organisation. In other words, George Hill was a much bigger force in this miscellaneous market, or call it what you will market, than Lehman Brothers, who were relatively small. I mean, George Hill had four partners in the market, and I think Lehman Brothers had one and a half. One permanent, one who sometimes turned up when we were busy, that sort of thing.
Have you got any idea why he went into that particular market? Had he started the firm, George M. Hill?
I can't tell you. All I know is it started in about 1908, and I have reason to believe that when they started, they were in the American market. And I honestly don't know, I should do, why they got into the Australian mining market. I really don't know. I think they must have made the decision before the war. I don't know.
Now, what was the Australian market like in the post-war period? Was it an interesting market in which to be jobbing? Was it an active market?
Well, it wasn't very active in after the war. No, it was quiet. I think, you know, the Australians, don't forget, were the same as us. They were still, they didn't have bread rationing like we did. One forgets all those sort of things. And their economy, I suppose, you know, they were feeling the strain of the war and all that business, so it was very quiet and I suppose you could say pretty uninteresting. But of course we did deal in a few other things around the world, as I said before, but not very much. But I give you some idea. When I joined George Hill in about, I think, 1948, about 1952, somebody told us that we should start a service company to save our tax position, help our tax position. So we went round to an accountant who was quite a clever chap and discussed this matter. And he, when we got back to the office, to my joint, we were both joint senior partner, Alec Hill, whose father had more or less retired. As I understand it, unless you and I make $6,000 a year each, it's not worth doing this business. He said, well, that's what I, he said, no, I agree with that. I don't understand it either. He said, I agree with this. I said, well, what do you feel about six? Well, he said, I can't see any way we're going to make more than $6,000 a year, as far as I can see, for years to come. I mean, And that was 1952. So that gives you some idea of what wasn't going on in the Australian market, and also one lived quite reasonably well. And when you consider that somebody in that market, well, I mean, it got to 100,000 a year or something, that makes you think, doesn't it?
Was it a fairly difficult period for jobbers or the stock exchange during the immediate post-war years while
It's only difficult, wasn't the turnover. You see, a jobber must, I mean, like a broker has to have turnover, a jobber has to have turnover. You can't, if he doesn't, this is where they're going wrong now, if you don't get turnover, you can't job, you can't be a job. Don't forget, a job as a bookmaker. You imagine going to the races, everybody goes to bookmaker and has 50p, or, well, they wouldn't take it now, but, you know, sort of £2, or they wouldn't make a living. And that was the sort of state it was. It wasn't, I didn't think there was the money about after the war. You know, we were still recovering. I mean, I don't know why income taxes, Christ knows what. I mean, so there wasn't the turnover, basically. As I say, we didn't think we were going to make more than 6,000 years. We were quite happy.
So did you spend a lot of time actually trying to make business rather than waiting for people coming up to you to deal?
No, I don't think that jobbers can make business. Basically, they can only make business if they think they know something. And I don't mean insider trading necessarily. I mean, when I came back from Australia, that was different. Things were changing then. But I come back from Australia and I'd say to somebody, look, I've been down Mount Isa mines and I've seen it and everybody else has seen it and I think it's a wonderful mine. And I think copper's going up and I think leads and zinc are going up and I think they must be bloody cheap. So to that extent, if they believed you, they would get on to, say, half a dozen clients. And we've just talked to Dick Davey, he's just come back from Australia, and he thinks that Mount Isa mines are bloody cheap, it's well run, and bonkety bonkety bonk. And therefore they come along and say, you know, buy a few thousand shares, but it could be, you know, it might get up to 100,000 shares, but otherwise, there's no way of making money unless you're dishonest, basically.
Did that happen? I'm not saying with your firm, but did jobbers, when times were difficult,
no, resort I'd to say those not, things? No. I mean, obviously, you get the nigger in the wood pile, but basically, I'd say no.
When did you first start visiting the mines? And visiting the countries?
1953 was my first effort.
Was that regarded as a slightly strange thing for a jobber to do, or was it by that time becoming regarded as
It was still pretty unfashionable. I think by that time people had flown to South Africa a bit more because it was much nearer, you know, and all that sort of thing, but because it took, well, that was before the jets, so you still got the old props, which took quite a long time. I think people went to South Africa, but going to Australia was still considered quite a... Anyway, people didn't look on Australia in the same light. They looked on South Africa, for example. So I was not exactly a pioneer. My partner went before I did, but it was quite something, really.
And what was your particular aim? With that first visit, was it?
Well,
my
particular aim was to go and see then agents who weren't very good in Melbourne, funnily enough. And I don't think we had fixed up with somebody in Sydney, and it was to go and visit somebody in Brisbane who was going to be an agent. And also, I got very friendly for some, I don't know why, with the Mount Isa mine people, or mining trust it was in those days. I think it was accidental, and so I wanted to get out of mine, so they invited me to get out of the mine, and I got VIP treatment and all that sort of thing, so it broadened my education. But it was fairly unusual.
Was there much understanding among the Australians about what you did as a jobber and where you fitted into the scheme of things?
I should say none at all, except when I tell them I was a bookmaker. Then they began You know what the Australians are like, gambling all the time. They, when I said I was a bookmaker, they began to sort of take more interest, I think. But they didn't really understand it. They didn't have it themselves. I don't think they could understand how we could make a living either. But then, and of course, you see, one had to go out there. It sounds rather pompous, but you had to go out there to educate our agents in what we thought they ought to do and what we wanted them to do. It's not so easy. And were they prepared to take a few risks? And if so, what? So that took a bit of time, and it took two or three years to get them properly organized, and us. But you have to understand each other, and of course trust each other.
And did these visits become a regular part of your?
Yeah, well, I've been there about 25 times. So I don't know. I mean, I practically began going every year, and it was invaluable. Basically, as I said earlier, I think I said to start this conversation, you don't learn on the telephone. You only learn by going there. And one of the troubles is you think you learn on the telephone. That's another danger. One of the worst things in life to think you know something, isn't it?
What was your position in the firm at this time? Were you in charge of a book? Were you one
I mean, the old George Hill really got too old. I mean, and I can't remember now. He died sometime. But Alec Hill and myself were joint senior partners. I mean, the other partners when I went in there were junior partners, and I was put above them. I mean, for age and all sorts of reasons. And so he and I were joint senior partners. And basically speaking, we didn't really have a book. We ran, Alec and I ran the book between us and directed what we thought the others should do. And the others had their own little books. And of course, when we became very busy, which was later on, then you had to divide the book up. Because I mean, you know, one stock you do 200 or 300 bargains in one day. Well, you try and deal 200 times, you think it takes 30 seconds or something, it's quite a lot of minutes. So, but in those days, we ran the whole lot, really.
Was the competition more or less the same as it had been in the pre-war period, or were
Yes, there were all, I think all the jobbers, the pre-war jobbers with their pre-war, all came back, if they weren't killed, but I think the firms came back. And they were still there, but I think we were successful, that's the answer.
Was it a very competitive market?
Not really. Everybody was trying to make a few pounds, but you know, in their own way, but it wasn't a very big market. It didn't become a big market at all, you know, Western Mining. I don't know when that started, was that 1960-something? By that time, you see, we'd been to Australia and went once or twice, so we'd really got our nice connections going, and we had everything going a treat, as I say it myself.
What was the importance of the connections? Now, you've mentioned the arbitrage.
Well, they were arbitrageurs, you see. Again, I mean, they did, but then they would take risks. And then, of course, the telephone system came along, and that was successful, you see. It wasn't, and I don't know when the telephone became usable. I don't think it was until about 1960. You could pick up the phone then, but I mean, before, as you probably don't know what you realise, you'd say, hello, and, hello? Oh, what? About 5 minutes passed, and you got nowhere at all. It was hopeless. So you didn't even try, and the chances were that you thought you'd dealt with the chap on the telephone, he hadn't heard you. So it didn't work. But when the telephone came, then your situation with the agent's a bit different then, you see, because he could then say, well, I'm going to sell 5,000 Western Mining, because I think they're quite high enough. And I'd say, right, I'll sell 5,000 and we'll sort of deal with Patrice. But he was taking the risk. But if I sent him a, well, he still sent cables at night because they're in bed. Sell 5,000 Western Mining. Well, that was my risk, and they dealt and took a commission. But sometimes we deal together and get ourselves a position between us and take the risks.
And then would you simply split the turn?
No, I suppose we didn't actually split it that sense, but we bought them back if we were about the same price, I mean, basically. But I mean, they may have sold them a bit earlier or a bit later or whatever. You couldn't do that.
Would you still be going into the market and openly bidding and offering as you had in the Kaffir or in the other markets during
very
the pre-war
seldom.
Days?
I never did very much. I don't got the wrong voice or something. Or I hardly ever opened my mouth, and nor did my partners either. That bidding and noise making began to die all around the stock exchange. They didn't hardly ever do it in the industrial market. It was nearly always the mining market that made the noise. I don't know why. And it died out. And I should say the last few years you wouldn't have nobody got out in the market and opened their mouth. Very occasionally, if you really wanted to make sure the whole world knew you were going to buy Mount Isa or something, you made a noise, but very seldom.
Did you ever contemplate moving into other markets? Or-